Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. And podcasts of prior shows are available there as well at both of those websites. Today is February 7th. 2018, the markets were down today, the Dow closing at 24,893, the NASDAQ at 7051, and the S&P at 2681. Our topic tonight is frequently asked questions. So that's what we're doing. For folks who might have been tuning in for the show on IRA Trust with attorney Jim Ruggiero, which was originally scheduled because of weather, we rescheduled that to, I believe, March 21st. So we thought, why don't we do frequently asked questions? Since we regularly get questions, I get questions every day at work and on the website, Your Financial Choices, people can send in questions there. And we have frequent questions that we get on air here as well. And in fact, if you have questions, you can call in and talk to us live on air. Or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can just call in. Lori C is in the studio. She'll answer the call. She'll write down the question and bring it into me, and I'll do my best to answer it. If you do decide to talk live on air with us, we do ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic. And that is works out great for tonight since it's frequently asked questions. You can kind of call in with any question. The phone number again is 610-758-8810. And email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. Real quick, you know, market fluctuations, a lot of people seem to be worried about that. I think that if you are educated about your portfolio and you are taking the time to understand what asset allocation is and diversification and how markets work, I hope that you're not one of those people who are worrying or panicking. Kind of all depends on your situation. So certainly if you are so upset that you can't sleep at night, you need to call your advisor and talk to them. But pullbacks and corrections are normal. And if you didn't think this huge run-up was normal, then you have to understand what goes up. Sometimes there's little volatility. It goes down a little bit. If we talk about average returns, we don't talk about the return you're getting today or the return you're getting for this month. It's average returns typically that we're looking at. So global economic fundamentals remain positive. I talked to Tim Roof, who's been on the show a few times, and he said things remain positive. So we do expect this to be a short-term blip, and hopefully there'll be some recovery over the next several weeks or months. So the most important thing is to remain disciplined and stay diversified. So that's that piece. Let's talk about some of the frequently asked questions that we get. More, I would say, how your financial choices impact you individually. Regular listeners know that I caution folks from getting their advice from things like the radio, television, or the newspaper. And here I sit on the radio talking about some financial education. But that is the point, financial education and understanding that it's about being aware so that you understand when something's happening in your own financial life that you may have to ask questions, take pause, research, get the information that you need before you make decisions, and then that you're reactive. We want you to be proactive. So some of the questions I typically get revolve around, you know, income, cash flow. Always get lots of questions around taxes, questions about retirement plans, questions about estate planning. So an hour in itself is not going to be enough time to answer, you know, all the questions that come up in those areas. But I thought I would hit on a few big ones that I think people might not have on their radar as much, because sometimes you don't know what questions to ask because you don't know what's impacting you. So I think this, you know, I'm going to try to hit on some of these areas. So for example, people who go to apply for Medicare, when you turn 65 and you don't otherwise have a qualified insurance, like if you're still working, you can use your employer's insurance quite often. So if you have qualifying health insurance, Social Security doesn't make you go apply for Medicare. You can use your employer's health insurance. But if you are 65 and you otherwise don't have coverage or your employer would require it, you could go file for Medicare. And the Medicare premiums are set, and there is a premium cost to that. What a lot of people don't understand, though, is that that premium can be adjusted based on your other income. So I'm going to talk about what that looks like in just a minute. But right now I have a caller on line one. We have Ken. Ken, hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, how can I help you?
Well, I just want to express a very important issue, not with myself or others of my age, but for my children and young people, that they understand that the most critical thing that they can do for their financial future is to start an IRA now.
Yay, I mean, Ken!
No.
It's true, right?
I am of an age where I'm about to take advantage of something that I started years ago, and I've had this conversation with my children who are in their 20s, and just to let them know that the sooner we start this process for them, that they have control of their financial position going forward, many years from now, when they don't ever think that day is going to arrive, they will actually, you know, hopefully look back and say, no, it was not such a bad idea.
Right. It comes sooner than people think. What I try to tell folks, Ken, because I'm all about like visualization and what you can kind of, you know, see, I say you go to work every day and you work really, really hard and you're earning that money. And you're working hard, and you're working hard to, you know, pay for things, but also for your hopefully retirement in the future. So you're working hard, and there's only so much hard work you can put in. To the extent you can then also save at the same time, now you get that money working for you, and now you're better positioned to get to that place you want to get to faster, to reach your goals faster, because not only are you working hard, but that money that you saved can also work hard for you. My brother recently retired, and he said, my gosh, my portfolio made $100,000 this year, and I didn't even have to lift a finger or work. Now, granted, he had a bigger balance, but still, people don't realize, you know, you could work a job making $50,000 a year, and if you've saved over all that period of time, your retirement account in, you know, 30, 40 years could give you those kinds of returns. It's crazy. Get your money working for you. It's hard to demonstrate that to young folks, but.
They are a critical mass because they're staring down the barrel of a gun where, in fact, their future may be bankrupt given what the current administration and recent, you know, policy is doing to future returns on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Right.
And so the only way that you can take hold of that now is in your own best interest to start your own account.
Right. Ken, I'm going to my break, but I really appreciate you calling in. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, good job. Folks, we're getting ready to take a break. But as Ken said, you know, it's about having options. And the more options you have, you're going to be able to face any other obstacles that you might have in the future. Folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
In 2018, WDIY is celebrating 23 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support, and we couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and we are talking about frequently asked questions tonight. And those frequently asked questions could be any question that you might have as well. The phone number here is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori C. She'll answer the phone, writes it down, she can bring it in to me. So Kenna just called with an encouragement for young folks to start saving for retirement. There's so many different ways you could do that. A lot of times I think that young people, if they have student loans, they, you know, you want to get those paid off. That's true. But maybe you could do a little bit of simultaneous kind of saving, making sure that if you have employer plans at work, that you're at least getting that match. It's amazing how many young people will start at a new job and not realize all of the employer benefits that are available to them. It's a little overwhelming when you're getting a new job to kind of take all that in and understand it. Sometimes you can't participate in a retirement plan at work until maybe you're there a year. So you also might get that information before you really are eligible. But when an employer matches contributions that you put in, maybe you put in 3%, they match 3%. Maybe you put in 6% and they match 3%. Maybe, you know, it changes. Maybe it's you put in 6 and they put in 2. Whatever it is, if an employer is matching your contributions, it's free money. So that's employer plans, 401ks, 403bs. As Ken said, IRAs. If you don't have an employer plan at work, or if you're below a certain income threshold, you can do a deductible IRA as well. We call those a traditional IRA. You get a deduction on your tax return, but maybe you don't need that deduction. Maybe you're in a low tax bracket if you're a young person and you're just starting out. Then you could check out something called the Roth IRA. That's another great way to save for retirement. The beauty of the Roth IRA is that you can always get out the original contributions. So as Ken said, to encourage young people to save for retirement, sometimes they're afraid they might need the money and they don't want to put it away. That's why I love the Roth. You could put money in the Roth if you're, you know, with all the eligibility requirements applying. You put money into the Roth IRA, and if you have to get out those original contributions, you can get them back out. So that's why I love that, and it's a great way for young people to learn how to invest and see the value and benefit of compounding, and understanding market volatility too, and knowing that sometimes you put it in, but if you're not going to touch it for 30 years, you can withstand some of the market volatility. So it teaches them some lessons at not too big of a cost for them when they're just starting out as well. So thanks, Ken, for that call. Again, folks, if you have questions, we're doing frequently asked questions tonight, or listeners' questions, 610-758-8810. Let me move back to the Medicare premium for a minute, and this is for listeners who are 65 or older. Sometimes we have people who retire at 65, and then they go in and they apply for Medicare, and Medicare is going to say, hey, we need to see your tax return because we have to know what Medicare premium to assess. And the Medicare premium is typically about $134 a month, and it comes right out of Social Security. If you're not collecting Social Security yet, you'll have to write a check for your Social Security. Otherwise, they just take it out. But if you're married filing joint, for example, and your income was over $170,000 2 years prior or the year prior when you're going to file for Medicare, if you told them, oh, my income was $200,000 because you were working, they're going to charge you extra amount on your premium. It's not going to be the $134. There's an adjustment. They're going to charge you maybe $186. Well, what do? Well, there is a special form that you can let Medicare know, hey, I am not working anymore. I've retired. I am not going to make $200,000 this year, even though it looks like I made $200,000 last year. I'm going to make, you know, 100. And so as long as I'm married, filing joint under 170, they're not going to assess that higher premium. And I've had so many people not realize that there is an exception when calculating that Medicare premium if you have retired. So please keep that in mind. That's why I mentioned that. And then there's other ways to manage your income sometimes to stay under those thresholds. And if I have time, I'll talk about that. But I have another caller on line one. We have Carolyn. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Lori.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. How can I help you?
I have a question about credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
How many credit cards are good to have? How many are too many? Is there a worry? And for me, I'm not talking about having a lot of balance, but I mean, some other people might have that situation. So.
Yeah. To tell you the truth, I don't know if I could even answer how many credit cards are good to have or not. I know that it could be essential to have a credit card if you want to function in certain situations, such as my daughter's boyfriend went to rent a car and he could not rent a car because he did not have a credit card. Because one of the things we find is young people love debit cards, and they wouldn't rent him the car because the debit card. So when you say how many credit cards are good to have, well, I would say maybe at least one would be good to have, because you will have situations where you might need to use a credit card in a sticky situation. And generally then we're talking about kind of a major credit card.
Right. Yeah. I didn't really mean the ones for the, just the particular store,
right.
But I happen to have two Visas and a MasterCard, and I'm thinking of getting rid of one of those.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's an advantage to just hanging on to them or not.
Well, here's something I do, Carolyn, which might put some of this into perspective. My husband and I use one credit card for almost everything. But for online purchases, I would generally use a different one. So that when I'm doing online purchases, maybe if you go on eBay or PayPal or something like that, use one credit card, that if the information is compromised, it's that one credit card. Other items we do some, like our grocery shopping is on a different credit card. So if I think I'm giving my credit card or using my credit card somewhere where it could get compromised, I use one that we infrequently use, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
For all my regular general uses, we use one credit card. And we do that really for the credits. We pay our credit card off every month, but we generally do it for the credits, mm-hmm. for points or cash back.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So people can get their credit reports to see if it's impacting their credit. So if you are someone who has 10 credit cards, I think that can impact it if it looks like you have credit available across, a number of different cards. And free credit reports are available through Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And if you have a good credit and you have a number of credit cards, then it must not have hurt. But the big thing in having credit cards is just making sure you pay them off every month. But I do think it is good to have one. The other thing I want to mention, and I mentioned this, recently in a college class, was that that I spoke at, was when I asked the kids, do any of you have credit cards? And I know nobody really raised their hand. I said, how many of you use debit cards? And the whole class raised their hand.
Wow.
People don't realize that debit cards could wipe out a bank account. If someone gets a hold of your credit card and it's tied to your bank account, they could wipe it out. Whereas a credit card, there's usually some protections there. And I have to tell you, I've been very comforted when the credit card companies call to see if someone's in Puerto Rico using my credit card. And I say no, and it's good because they didn't put the charges through.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
The credit cards kind of watch for some of that unexpected activity.
Mm-hmm.
So can't tell you exactly how many are good to have, but it's what's most important is how well you use them.
Okay.
Okay, but I'm going up to a break, Carolyn.
Okay.
So are we good?
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
For listening. Take
okay.
care. Have a good night.
Good night.
Folks, the phone number tonight is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. And tonight we are taking listeners' questions or frequently asked questions. I'm just going to circle back to finishing up on this Medicare premium because, again, I think a lot of people don't realize this. I don't recall when they implemented this Medicare income-related adjustment, but it has been several years, and generally they look back to your tax return from 2 years prior, and this is where sometimes people don't realize that if the administration is looking back 2 years on your tax return and you were working and your income was, and again, this is an example, your income's over $170,000 married filing joint, they're going to charge you an adjusted amount for your Medicare unless you tell them that number, you know, had your working wages in it. So there is a form on the website that you can request if they already assessed it and you pull out your Social Security statement and you say, gosh, Lori, I just retired last year. I didn't know Medicare was charging me $166 a month, but not just you, your spouse too. So now there's two of you paying this extra $53 each in my little story. That's $107 a month extra you might be paying that you wouldn't have had you realized that you just had to inform them that you had retired. And then there's some other circumstances, too. That's just the big one off the top of my head. So watch that for folks over 65, especially during those periods of transition. So what if you are you're not working, you're on Medicare, but maybe you have a lot of other income on your return. Maybe you have pensions, annuities, Social Security, IRA distributions, interest, dividends. And you say, hey, my income, Lori, is $171,000 married filing joint. I'm paying an extra $53 a month each. Spouses, again, we're at $107 a month. I'm paying an extra $1,000 a month. $53.50 each. That's $107 a month times 12 months. Let's say it's $1,200, $1,300 a year, and my income is only over $1,000. Is there anything I can do about that? Well, yeah, then we would look at your income to see how we could adjust it otherwise. Maybe you, tax-exempt income, by the way, gets added to your page one income in that calculation. It's called modified adjusted gross income. So it's not just about making, you know, changing your dividends to tax-exempt. It could be something else. Maybe you had a lot of capital gains. Well, maybe you needed to see if you could harvest some capital losses. Maybe one of you still has a part-time job and you're working, making $5,000 a year, and you could have done a traditional IRA contribution or something like that. If you're under age 70, you could still make a contribution to an IRA. So there would be certain things, or you could just, you know, stop the part-time job. So there are certain things you can do to modify your income. So watch for that. Let's talk about Social Security for a minute as a frequently asked question. So often people think, well, I retired at 62. I'm going to go collect Social Security because that's what we do. Well, it may or may not be what we do, depending on what other income you might have or cash flow you have. If you are someone who is very comfortable and maybe you have a big pension or investment income, or you live a very modest life and you don't spend a lot of money, maybe you don't need that Social Security yet at age 62. Because if you collect at 62, you take a permanent reduction in your benefit. Maybe you could afford to wait a little longer. So think about that. Don't make assumptions about when you have to collect Social Security. Some people think, well, I'm full retirement age, I have to collect Social Security. No, if you're full retirement age, you don't have to collect Social Security if you don't need it. Maybe you could let that continue to grow. There's an 8% premium per year on deferring your benefit from full retirement age to age 70. Maybe that makes sense if you have longevity in your family and you have other means. So there's so many factors that go into these decisions. One other item that some people, I think, are missing on this Social Security analysis is, if you were 62 by December 31st of 2015, and you wait till full retirement age to collect, and you have a spouse who also is eligible to collect, you have an option to file a restricted application on your spousal benefit. It's one of the little loopholes that has subsequently been closed. But for those people who were 62 by December 31st of 2015, once you reach full retirement age, if you've not collected yet, you still might have some planning options around Social Security. So that is a little note for those folks who were 62 as of December 31st of 2015. Some people ask about savings bonds. Savings bonds, you know, should I keep them, or they forget about them? That's what I find most often. People forget about their savings bonds. And, you know, I had someone come in with savings bonds from the 60s and they had never redeemed them. You can do an inventory of your savings bonds on a website, treasurydirect.gov. You should never have to pay for that. It's so easy to do. It's crazy. treasurydirect.gov. And there's a link, you know, get started for my calculator. You can enter. You don't even have to enter the serial number on the savings bond. It doesn't do anything for the calculation. The reason you enter the serial number into the inventory is to help you track them. And that's for people who have pages and pages of savings bonds. But what is most important is to know the issue date, the denomination, and the type, which, you know, generally we're looking at EE bonds. Some people have I bonds, some people have E bonds, which are, you know, all matured by now. So those are ones that definitely should be cash. But what that inventory will give you is the interest to date, the next maturity date, or the next payment date, and then the maturity date. And this is really great because it gives you an idea of the tranches of bonds that you have. And if some have already matured, you really should go get those cashed. They don't issue paper bonds anymore. But for those folks who have the paper bonds, the Treasury Department is not automatically sending you a 1099 to report the interest. If you do it electronically online, I've had folks get their 1099 saying, here's your savings bond interest. You say, wait, I didn't cash the savings bonds. No, it's because they're electronic and the Treasury knows they matured and you have to report the interest. For folks who have those paper bonds, they don't report the interest until you go cash them and you get it. So you march into the bank with your EE bonds, and typically any federal bank will cash those for you, and you'll get a 1099 from the U.S. Treasury Bureau of Public Debt to tell you how much interest you have to report. That interest is taxable for federal purposes, but not for state purposes. Also, for certain bonds issued after, oh golly, I don't remember the date now, but certain savings bonds issued after a certain date can be used to fund 529 accounts, and then you don't have to report the interest. And that all depends on how much other income you have on your return. So here are some nuggets that folks might not realize you might have some options for. So grandma and grandpa could go out, maybe see if they can do some fancy things with some 529s maybe for themselves, because there's certain ways you can fund 529s and not report that interest. So watch out for that. Savings bonds and maturing, watch for the values. And it also gives you the interest rate, which is really great because it lets you know, what kind of interest rate you're getting. And some of those are still getting great interest rates. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
The time now is 6:30. You're tuned to WDIY Allentown, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station. You can hear us at 88.1 FM. Also, our translators, 93.9 FM Easton in Phillipsburg, 93.7 Fogelsville in Trexlertown, and around the world at WDIY.org. Lehigh Valley weather tonight, a chance of rain up to about 7 o'clock. Lori's going to be driving home in the dry weather. Mm-hmm. Cloudy skies during the evening, then gradual clearing. Temperature should stay above freezing till after midnight, then dropping to a low of 19 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, a high of 30 degrees. Thursday night, partly cloudy, low of 15. Friday, a slight chance of snow after 1 in the afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy. And cooling off Friday night to 29, and then Saturday, still a slight chance of snow, freezing rain Saturday morning, otherwise a high near 45, a low 36. Currently 35 degrees at 6:31.
Thank you, Wally. Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. Folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, you can give a question to Lori C. She'll write it down, bring it in to the studio. I appreciate questions. I love questions. That's my favorite part of the show. Before the show started, I did have another question come in that someone had asked, sold their home. Do they need to worry about income taxes on the sale of their home? So very excited that they sold their home, wondered about the income tax. And this is an area that many people still don't understand the rules on, because guess what? If you never sold your home in the past 15 years, you don't pay attention to the tax laws for selling a home, because you just don't think of it. It doesn't apply to you. So, you know, you don't know. So it's always worthwhile to revisit the rules on selling a principal residence. So if you have lived and owned a home 2 out of the last 5 years and you're single and the gain on the home is less than $250,000, you do not have to pay any income taxes on the gain. If you're married filing joint, it's $500,000. So that's 2 out of the last 5 years owned and lived in the home. There was some talk about extending that time period under tax reform, but it did not go through. So a lot of people are confused by that as well. And that doesn't apply. It's still 2 out of the last 5 years, $250,000 gain exclusion if you're single, and $500,000 if you're married filing joint. In fact, what will happen when you go to sell the home, typically the realtors will run through pages and pages and stacks of papers for you to go through. And in that stack is going to be some questions. Did you live in this home? Was this your principal residence? Did you live in this home 2 out of the last 5 years? So they ask those questions. And if the sale price, I believe, is under $250,000, I don't think they even send you a tax reporting document. So if the sale is, let's say, $300,000, I think they still might issue a 1099-S. But it doesn't mean it's taxable. It just means it's getting reported. And then you have to actually report the transaction on your tax return to reflect that it was not taxable, because it was, you know, if you had a cost basis of, let's say, $60,000 and you sold it for $300,000, you'd have a gain of $240,000, but you're single and you lived in it 2 out of the last 5 years. So that all kind of gets reported on the return to prove that it wasn't a taxable event. So watch out for that. Back to savings bonds for a second. I did have someone ask, they had savings bonds and they had wondered if they should cash them and pay off their mortgage. And the mortgage oh, golly, now I don't remember because I didn't finish answering the question. But I think the mortgage was like maybe $35,000. And let's pretend the interest rate was, I don't know, 4%. Should they pay off their mortgage? Well, they have savings bonds. We looked at what the savings bonds were paying. Some of the savings bonds were paying 4%. Some of the savings bonds were paying 1.5%. Well, should they pay off the mortgage? It might make sense or not. Sometimes we get a deduction on our tax return for mortgage interest that we're paying. With tax reform, people may not benefit from that tax deduction. It depends on what other deductions you might have. And that's because the standard deduction has gone so high that some people aren't going to benefit from itemizing anymore. So to the extent you benefit from itemizing and you benefit from the tax deduction, that really makes, let's say, a 4% mortgage rate and a 25% tax bracket, that would bring, let's say, the effective rate of that down to 3%. Well, if I'm getting 4% of my savings bonds, that might be a better deal. I might not want to pay off my savings bonds. Then you take it a little further. Okay, well, maybe we're not going to get the deduction on our tax return anymore. And maybe the savings bonds are at 1.5%. Well, then that might look like a no-brainer. Let's cash these savings bonds, pay the income tax on the 1.5%, and pay off the bonds. Or pay off the mortgage. But did you hear what I said? I also said pay the income tax. So yeah, it's only 1.5% rate of return on the savings bonds. Maybe they're not matured yet. They're still earning 1.5%. If I cashed a big chunk of savings bonds and put all that income on my tax return, then I might be paying 25% income tax rate on the income that I'm reporting on the return. So maybe that wasn't such a good deal. In this case, this person also just recently lost their job. Well, I'm not sure I would want them to cash out all the savings bonds and pay off that mortgage because maybe they might need the savings bonds for cash flow. So you don't always have to jump into these things. You have to really think them through. And the beauty of understanding your financial choices, which is what I love doing every week, is educating people, is that you have to understand how all the pieces have impacted the other decisions that you're making. So it's not just about, in this little story in the example with the paying off a mortgage, it's not just the interest rate you're paying on the mortgage. It's not just the income, the rate of return you're getting on your investments, or in this case, the savings bonds. It's also the impact of the taxes, factoring that in. And it's also the impact of cash flow. So many things just came together there. The decisions on the investment, the decision on the taxes, the decisions on the cash flow, just incredible. So you want to make sure that whatever decision you're making, you're factoring in all of the choices to make the optimal choice in your situation for your, you know, at that time. Let me just mention one other quick question. What I used to get quite frequently was questions about gifting. You know, it can be confusing even when it's simple. So we can gift to anybody, right? We can make gifts to people. And people sometimes worry because they'll hear people talk about a gift tax and, oh no, I can't gift to someone because I have to have this gift tax, or, oh, I can gift, but there's like this annual amount I can gift. Well, folks, when we're talking about a gift tax, we're talking about really some federal rules that might come into play depending on how much you're gifting and if you think you're going to be subject to the federal estate tax. So each of us has an exemption, a lifetime exemption, that if our assets never go over this amount, we won't have a federal estate tax. And if we gift that amount, we won't have, under that exemption, we won't have any gift taxes. It's only if we go over these big lifetime exemptions might we have gift tax or a federal estate tax. And they've just raised those exemption amounts with the recent tax reform, and it's $11.2 million per person. $11.2 million. So today I could walk out of here, gift $11 million worth of assets, which I don't have, but let's pretend I do. I'll visualize it. I could gift away $11 million today. I've not used any of my exemption. And I don't have any gift tax because I'm under the exemption amount. What the IRS would require, though, is that I do file a gift tax return, because the IRS has to keep track of how much of that lifetime exclusion or exemption have we used during our lifetime. They keep track of it. I have clients that I have gift tax returns I've done for many, many, many years, and it accumulates. Each year they're giving gift amounts, it accumulates, and they're eating into that lifetime exemption. The annual gift amount that we talk about is an annual amount that the IRS doesn't care that we give away, and it's not going to eat into our lifetime exemption. So when we talk about, oh, we can gift something without having to file a gift tax return or pay gift tax, that was just increased from $14,000 per person, per donor, per year to $15,000. So now I have three kids. I could give them each $15,000. That's $45,000 from myself, $15,000 each, and I don't have to report it at all. My husband could do the same thing. He could do $15,000 to each of the three kids. We don't have to report anything. If we each did $20,000 to each of the children, technically I need to file a gift tax return and report that I used $5,000 times three kids, which is $15,000, I used out of my lifetime exclusion or exemption of $11,200,000. All right, so that's kind of the rules around the gifting. It's just whether you give more. Doesn't mean I'm going to have to pay gift tax. So, and let me finish that example then. So if I gifted $15,000 out of my lifetime exclusion, I report that to the IRS, but because I didn't go over the $11.2 million, I don't have to pay any gift tax right now, okay? So you can always give more than the annual amount. It's just that you might have to file a return to report the amount of your exemption that you've used, your lifetime exemption. Okay, so that's kind of income and cash flow, frequently asked questions. Let me talk about taxes for a minute, some of the frequently asked questions. Next week, I am going to talk about financial planning or tax planning under the new tax reform. What am I going to talk about? The new world of planning under tax reform. So that's what I'm going to talk about next week. So I don't want to talk too much about taxes, but I thought I would kickstart our tax season by just referencing a few frequently asked questions in case you yourselves are having them. And that is right now, you know, I have all my tax information, but I don't have my 1099. Should I send it into my tax preparer? Well, folks, if you have most of your tax information, you know, check with your tax preparer, because sometimes they can get a jump start right now while it's not too busy yet, because everybody's waiting for those 1099s from our brokerage houses. So let's pretend you have, you know, a couple Social Security statements, or maybe you have a couple W-2s and maybe some Schedule A items, real estate taxes. They could get that information in, and then the only thing they'd have to wait for is that 1099 when it comes in. So you might want to check if you have everything together for the most part, other than one tax document. It doesn't mean you should necessarily wait. Maybe you want to get a jump start. So start organizing that information if you haven't already. Tax preparers don't need envelopes, and they don't always need all the extra, you know, privacy policies or slips of paper that are in those envelopes sometimes. What you're watching for in the mail is anything that says important tax information enclosed on the outside. It's a, you know, a IRS requirement that if someone is sending you tax information, they have to put that on the outside of the envelope, important tax information enclosed. If you're getting envelopes that might, you know, kind of seem similar or say statements kind of like that, it could be just junk mail. You want to maybe open it and glance at it, but know that the junk mail probably wouldn't use the exact words that the IRS requires, because they'd probably be in some kind of violation. So be alert and wary of any organizations or folks who are out there trying to scam you or scare you or make you think that it's an important tax document and they're asking for money or asking for information. This is really the time of year you have to be very, very careful with scammers. Don't answer emails from the IRS, because they don't email you. Don't go put your taxes due on a debit card because no one is, the IRS doesn't take payments from the CVS on a debit card. So be very, very careful of any scams and alerts. Don't give out your information. Don't send your social security number in an email. Don't attach your tax documents in an email to anyone because your social security number is probably in that document you're attaching. So just be smart and careful with what you're doing. How long should you keep your tax returns is a question we get often. I keep them a long time. Technically, it's probably 3 years. I would suggest at least 6 years. But if you have any information that's carried forward from an old return, keep the returns as far back as that event that generated that carry forward, losses, business losses, capital losses, that type of thing. So be careful with that. Folks, we only have 15 minutes left. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and you're listening to Your Financial Choices. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori C. She answers the phones, and she'll write it down and bring it into the studio. And that's 610-758-8810. Tonight's topic is frequently asked questions, or listeners' questions, as I like to call it. I would love to do listeners' questions every single week. That would be great. But, you know, there's so many shy listeners that they're not always calling in. So, but you're welcome to. It's really easy. Let me talk a little bit more about some of these frequently asked questions around taxes. Oh, I wanted to mention what I've been hearing from a number of people is they will say, well, we can't itemize anymore. Or we can't take charitable contributions anymore, or we can't deduct that anymore. There is a lot of confusion around the tax reform and how it relates to 2017 and even how it relates to 2018. Believe me, it is confusing for CPAs. I can't even imagine how confusing it might be to the general public. I will say that what I feel people listened or heard when they were talking about tax reform is that it was going to become so simple that you could do it on a 3x5 card, and that is not the case at all. The whole tax reform evolved from, I would say, something much more simplified than what we ended up with the original House. It was much simpler, and that didn't fly. So then the Senate came up with some, changes that didn't quite fly. And then the committee came out and kind of modified it a little bit more. And it even got even modified after that. So a number of things changed. But in fact, 2017, we still can itemize deductions if those deductions are over what we call our standard deduction. The standard deduction is still at the regular amounts for 2017. It's only in 2018 that they've doubled the standard deduction. So a lot of folks who were itemizing before in 2016 will, should be reviewing that for 2017. You want to review to see if you can still itemize. Yes, you can still take charitable contributions if you're itemizing on Schedule A and your real estate taxes and your state and local taxes and miscellaneous itemized deductions. If you have alternative minimum tax, that still exists. That still exists in 2017. It might wipe out some of those deductions you thought you were getting on your Schedule A's. Alternative minimum tax doesn't let us take a deduction for state and local taxes or real estate taxes anyway. So you want to really pay attention to whether or not you still might be able to itemize. The big thing in tax reform that they did was in 2017, we expected the medical deduction to be limited to 10% of your adjusted gross income. And in fact, they lowered that back to 7.5% for everybody. There was a few years where it was 7.5% for people under 7.5% for over 65 and 10% for people under 65. But now it's 7.5% for everybody in 2017. So if you have high medical expenses, you might still be able to itemize in 2017 and in 2018. Had a question. The new laws seem to penalize people who are generous givers to charities. Is this true? And this goes to the question where I've had people say, well, I can't deduct my charitable giving anymore. That's not quite the case. What happened, or what's going to happen? 2017, just like usual. What happens in 2018 when they double the standard deduction and they eliminate the state and local and real estate tax deduction, except capping it at $10,000, and they eliminate the miscellaneous itemized deductions, what's going to happen is so many people who in the past would itemize, getting over that standard deduction threshold because they had state and local taxes and real estate taxes and charitable contributions and miscellaneous deductions that went over that standard deduction. So married, filing, joint, I think 2017 might be like $12,600. So all of those things added up together, if you're married, filing, joint, and it's over 12.6, you get to itemize, then you really get the full benefit of your charitable giving. But now, if my real estate taxes and state and local taxes are capped at 10, and my charitable giving was 10, that would be a $20,000 Schedule A. But now the standard deduction is 24. Well, now I'm not going to itemize, right? So I just made a charitable contribution of $10,000 and I'm no longer getting a tax benefit from it. Many people have said to me, well, Lori, I don't give just because I'm looking for a tax deduction. I give because I'm charitable. And I think that's wonderful. And a lot of people do give. But I will guarantee you that a lot of people are incentivized to give charitably because they know they are getting a charitable deduction. It just makes them that much extra charitable. Well, now I am afraid that we might see donations go down. So what can we do about that? There are some things that we can do. One of the things we were looking at in 2017 prior to the year end was having our clients look at their charitable giving over the next 5 years. And to the extent they had the money to make a bigger deduction, we had them do it kind of all in 1 year using something called a donor advised fund. So I had a gentleman who gives $5,000 a year away over 4 years until he turned 70. We did 5,000 times 4 years was $20,000. He put $20,000 into a donor advised fund. He got the full deduction in 2017. On his tax return at the time he did it, and he did it using appreciated securities, so he even got a better deduction, a better tax result because of that. He didn't have to sell the securities to fund this charitable giving. And he gets the $20,000 deduction, saved him a lot of money in 2017. And then from the donor advised fund, he makes his annual contribution of the $5,000 a year for 4 years. So he's still doing his regular charitable giving, and he got the full deduction. When he turns age 70 and a half, so he did it through the age 70 and a half, now he's going to have something called his required minimum distribution from his retirement account. He has other sources of money and cash flow. He still wants to be charitably inclined. Now he can use his IRA to do his charitable giving, and he will lower his income by that amount. So for this person asking a question, if you turn age 70 and a half and you have an IRA, you can do qualified charitable distributions, we call them QCDs, out of your IRA, and then that income does not have to get reported on your tax return. There's certain requirements around that, and you have to make the check, you have to ask the custodian to make the check directly to the charity. So they write the check to the charity. They might mail it to you to deliver to your nonprofit, but you can do it, and it lowers the income on page one. So that's great. So what this has forced us into doing is not necessarily simplifying the whole process, because there's a lot of other pieces of the tax reform that are going to require a lot of fancy planning. But this hasn't necessarily simplified it, but it's giving people options and thought about how to do it differently. So I'm going to kind of put this in a reverse order, meaning maybe my person today doesn't have so much money that they could fund a donor-advised fund today. Maybe instead they might not give for maybe the 4 or 5 years, put that money aside each year for 4 or 5 years if you do indeed want the tax deduction, and then in 4 or 5 years do the big contribution to the charity using a donor-advised fund. And in the past, we called it hopscotching deductions. So 1 year, someone would take a standard deduction. The next year, they'd do all their charitable giving and itemize. The next year, they'd do the standard deduction. The next year, they'd do a big charitable distribution. That hopscotching, because the standard deduction is so high now, that hopscotching might not be every other year anymore. It might be every 4 years or 5 years, and using techniques such as the donor advised fund. And maybe you don't have to do it through the donor advised fund. Maybe you just make that big gift once every 4 or 5 years or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to our nonprofits. You know, what happens is in the past, you've heard the government relies on these nonprofits to run so many local programs, grassroots programs in the communities to help people, whether it's programs like, you know, WDIY runs to educate and inform our listening audience. It's even those programs that are putting food in people's mouths and helping young children learn how to read and get educated and helping our homeless. So a lot of the you know, government relies on our nonprofits to do some of these programs, and we certainly hope that maybe there could be a Band-Aid put on this, because what we might find over time is some of this tax reform might not be working. Nothing says they can't change it. But, you know, there could be a huge outcry if we see our nonprofits not receiving the same kind of donations that they've seen in the past. Or maybe they have to rely more on corporate giving as well. And on that note, I should also mention that if you are doing charitable giving, you know, a lot of the corporations will do matching. So you want to make sure that you're putting in for that if you haven't already and done it for your 2017 contributions, if they give you a window for that. So got to watch out for tax reform, but I will talk about that more next week as well. And if folks have questions, if you have questions over the next several weeks, you know, during tax season, I will tend to do a lot of shows on tax preparation and tax planning and what you kind of have to pay attention to. And if you have ideas, you're welcome to send them to me. I'm happy to do shows on topics you're interested in hearing more about. If there's something I don't know, it's my favorite time to do a show is to learn about it. So if I don't know something, I've got to do a show on it so I could learn more about it. Because even I don't know everything, and we don't always know the questions to ask about things we don't know about, right? So if you have topics, you can send them through the website at yourfinancialchoices.com, or you can always call in each week to us here at the show, 610-758-8810, and give us your ideas of topics you'd like us to cover. I love doing the show, and I do it for the listeners, so might as well make sure we're covering topics that you are interested in. And next week, we will talk about the new world of planning under tax reform, so I look forward to that. I want to thank the listeners for calling in tonight. I want to thank Wally for being here and helping out tonight, and Lori C., of course, who's here every week. Coming up, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. And I'm coming up a little short here, Wally, but you can fill in. Have a great week, folks, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a good night.